Patriot Correspondence 7.2. The dangers of centralized banking are not new knowledge. For centuries, people, including many of our founding fathers, have tried to warn us of the threats posed by institutions like the Federal Reserve. Christopher Gadsden, the principal leader of the South Carolina Patriot Movement during the American Revolution, said in 1764, "The evils attending a wanton exercise of power in some of the colonies by issuing a redundancy of paper currency has always been avoided by a proper attention to the dangerous consequences of such a practice and the fatal influence it must have upon public credit." In 1775, during the Revolution, the founders attempted to use paper money without gold or silver backing, and they found that the inflation robbed them of any value. It didn't work. Fiat currency. By 1787, George Washington's position on fiat currency was clear in a letter to Jay Bowen. "Paper money has had the effect in your state that it will ever have, to ruin commerce, oppress the honest, and open the door to every species of fraud and injustice." But as history will show, he couldn't stop it. How did these early warnings fail to prevent central banking disasters that we are living through in the 21st century? Here's a quick history of the early moves made by the founders and how it all turned out. There are two founding fathers most responsible for the earliest forms of American central banking. The first is Robert Morris, born 1734, Liverpool, Great Britain. Political party, Federalist. Morris served as a member of the Pennsylvania Legislature, the Second Continental Congress, and the United States Senate. And he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the U.S. Constitution. He served as the first superintendent of finance of the United States. Along with Alexander Hamilton, he is widely regarded to as one of the founders of central banking in the United States. Morris established the Bank of North America, the first congressionally chartered central bank to operate in the United States. Morris was a key economic official, the key economic official in the country during the Revolution. Shortly after taking office as superintendent of finance, he convinced Congress to establish the Bank of North America, the first bank to operate in the United States. It was established as a private institution governed by its investors, but it was subject to inspection by Morris, the superintendent of finance. In January 1782, after receiving its charter from Congress, the Bank of North America commenced operations, and the bank's currency soon achieved wide circulation. The bank took the government's deposits, provided loans to Congress, and issued banknotes. As of January 1st, 1783, the public debt was $42 million, of which 19% was foreign debt. Morris grew frustrated by the weakness of the government under the Articles of Confederation and resigned as superintendent of finance in 1784. This position preceded the Treasury Secretary. He was later declined Washington's offer to serve as the nation's first Treasury Secretary, and we're going to get to him next. He suggested Alexander Hamilton for the position. Morris did. In the Senate, Morris supported Hamilton's economic program. We'll get to that in a minute. He pressed for many of the same policies that he had as superintendent of finance, basically a federal tariff, a national bank, a federal mint, and the funding of the national debt. Same thing we're stuck with today. During and after his service in the Senate, Morris went deeply into debt, speculating on land in the 1790s. Unable to pay his creditors, he was confined to debtor's apartment adjacent to a prison from 1798 to 1801, 3-year hitch in debtor's prison. After being released, he lived a private life in Philadelphia until his death in 1806. That's Robert Morris, the second and more important founder who brought us central banking. It's Alexander Hamilton. Born in either 1755 or 1757 on Nellis Island in one of the British Leeward Islands. Political party, Federalist. Hamilton, orphaned before he was 10, grew up working in a trade house in the West Indies. After the Revolution, in 1784, he founded the Private Bank, the Private Bank of New York, one of the oldest still existing banks in the United States. Bank of New York. He founded it. 5 years later, Washington appointed Hamilton as the first Secretary of Treasury in 1789. As such, Hamilton was the main author of the economic policies of George Washington's administration. Quite naturally, that's the position of the Treasury Secretary. He took the lead from the government's funding of the state's debts, as well as establishing the federal bank's first two de facto banks. We talked about the Bank of North America, founded by Morris already. And then the First Bank of the United States, a system of tariffs as well, and friendly trade relations with Britain. That was how Hamilton approached it. His vision included a strong central government led by a vigorous executive branch, a strong commercial economy, government control banks. Right from the start, they said the government's going to control the banks. Support for manufacturing and a strong military. That was Hamilton's position on these matters. Alexander Hamilton successfully argued that the implied powers of the Constitution provide legal authority to fund a national debt, to assume state debts, and to create the first bank, the Bank of the United States. Hamilton's views became the basis for the Federalist Party, which was opposed to the Democratic Republican Party led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Hamilton saw his office like that of the British First Lord of the Treasury and as the equivalent of a prime minister. To Hamilton, the proper handling of the government debt would also allow America to borrow at affordable interest rates and would be the stimulant to the economy. So he just took the model straight out of London. He's going to say, we're going to have the London banking model here now. As Treasury Secretary, he established against the intense opposition of Secretary of State Jefferson, country's first de facto central bank. Hamilton justified the creation of the bank and other increased federal powers under Congress's constitutional powers to issue currency, to regulate interstate commerce, and do anything else that would be, quote, necessary and proper to enact the provisions of the Constitution. Hamilton's policies as Treasury Secretary, greatly affected the United States government and still continues to influence his constitutional interpretation, specifically of the necessary and proper clause, set precedents for federal authority that are still used in courts and are considered an authority on constitutional interpretation. Hamilton has been portrayed as the, quote, patron saint of American school of economic philosophy that dominated our country since the Civil War. Not before it. He firmly supported government intervention in favor of business. Hamilton opposed the British ideas of free trade, however, which he believed skewed benefits to colonial imperial powers in favor of protectionism, which he believed would help develop the emerging economy. A fledgling polity resembles the 45th president of the United States, during which this Patriot correspondence is being broadcast. Hamilton proposed to fully fund all federal debts and assume all state debts and to pay for those debts by issuing new federal bonds. Hamilton argued these measures would restore confidence in public credit and help revitalize the economy. His opponents attacked his proposals as unfairly beneficial to the speculators who had purchased many of the government debt certificates. In June 1790, Secretary of State Jefferson convinced Morris, Hamilton, and Madison to agree to a compromise in which the government assumed state debts while a new federal capital would be established on the Potomac River. with the backing of all four leaders, the Compromise of 1790, as it became known, was approved by Congress, thus establishing the first bank of the United States, modeled on the Bank of England in 1791. Of course, the foremost founding father who opposed the establishment of European-style central banking in the United States was Thomas Jefferson, born 1743 in Virginia, political party, Democratic Republican, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, third president of the United States. Here are his words on central banking in the period. All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise, not from the defects of the Constitution or the Confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. To John Adams in a letter, 1787. In the next year, 1788, Jefferson wrote, "Paper is poverty. It's only the ghost of money and not money itself." 10 years later, Jefferson writing to John Taylor, "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the genuine principles of its Constitution. I mean, an additional article taking from the government the power of borrowing." They missed it. He missed it. He didn't push for it. 10 years later, we are stuck with it. In the same year, Jefferson said, "Our whole system of banks is a violation of every honest principle of banks. There are no honest bank but a deposit of bank, a bank of deposit. A bank that issues paper at interest is a pickpocket and a robber, but the delusion will have its course, and an aristocracy is growing out of them that will be as fatal as the feudal barons if unchecked in time." That was 1810, John Adams' quote. He was echoing all of Jefferson's points of view. This is how the founders were split. After the war in 1812, Jefferson wrote, "And I sincerely believe you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale." He said this in a letter to John Taylor in 1816, towards the end of his life. Here's some background on the economic outlook. Thomas Jefferson and the battle he faced against central banking. All right, some more, those were quotes. Now here's some facts. Jefferson devised the world's first decimal currency, a dollar divided in 100 cents. That was invented in the USA by Thomas Jefferson. He envisioned a country where farmers who owned and worked their own land would be the dominant force in the economy and politics. All right, globalists today say that he had this hatred of money men and commerce. And because of Thomas Jefferson, it all led to an unruly banking and regulatory system prone to periodic and catastrophic breakdowns. The banksters complained it was because of Jefferson that America now has more banks than all the world combined today, and a fragmented financial regulatory system that adds to chaos. This is globalist revisionist history. That's how he's viewed now by the pro-modern monetary theory theorists, I should say. But is this really the case? Let's investigate what the real differences between Jefferson and Hamilton were. They clashed over the massive leftover war debts from the Revolution. Neither of them were necessarily the cause of that, and it resulted in an unstable money supply and whether the country needed a central bank. Jefferson and his allies eventually halted Hamilton's system during Hamilton's lifetime. That's the key thing to understand. Jefferson and his allies eventually halted Hamilton's system during Hamilton's lifetime. Central bankers will tell you today that the failure to establish one Bank of London clone in Washington, D.C. during Jefferson's time set America on a course of bank fraud and failure, a chaotic money supply, and a boom-bust cycle that resulted in major financial crises every 20 years. President Washington ultimately sided with Hamilton, despite the quote that we started this off with, and signed a bill chartering the Bank of the United States for 20 years. When the Constitution was adopted in 87, the United States was in financial turmoil, unable to pay its debts, even the interest on them. It was a mess. It was a hodgepodge of nearly worthless bank notes and foreign coins. Credit was hard to obtain and capital was scarce. By the time Hamilton finished his six-year term as Treasury Secretary in 1795, American bonds were selling in Europe. The financial system and money supply were stable. The economy was growing. When the Jeffersonians rose to power in the following years, they decentralized Hamilton's system and created a new banking arrangement with a money supply loosely controlled by states. Jefferson, on the other hand, was very strict in his view of the Constitution. You know, he found no specific authorization for the bank, and he stuck with that position throughout. This controversy eventually was settled by the Supreme Court of the United States in McCulloch versus Maryland, which in essence adopted the Hamiltonian view, granted government broad freedom to select the best means to execute its enumerated powers, and specifically gave rise to the doctrine of implied power. Nevertheless, in 1811, the charter of the Bank of the United States was not renewed. So they went 1791 to 1811, the 20 years of the first Bank of the United States. Because the government's inability to borrow for the what? The war the next year, 1812, maybe getting preyed on by banking imperialist powers. There is no central bank running in that country. Let's have a war with them. A second bank in the United States was established. It took 4 years, but 1816. It got off to a shaky start. Failed to exercise much control over state banks. By 1836, 20 years later, Andrew Jackson killed it. Charter expired and did not renew it. This is what the banking industry in the United States proceeded to do, ladies and gentlemen. This is the reaction from the banking markets from the period of the early first half of the 1800s. Half of the private banks founded between 1810 and 1820, they failed by 1825. That was before the second bank's charter expired. Half of those founded in the 1830s, when it did expire, were bankrupt 9 years later, okay, by 1845. By the 1850s, there were more than 7,000 varieties of valid bank notes in circulation. So banks popped up and printed their own fiat. It was private fiat chaos, and there was no U.S. currency recognized. The lack of a central bank that could exercise control over interest rates supposedly made the United States prone to bigger booms and bigger busts than other countries. In 1837, the year after the expiration of the Second Bank of the United States, the country experienced its first catastrophic financial panic. Private banks failed by the hundreds. All the banks collapsed. All right. 20 years later, in another panic that swept through the economy, caused a depression that only ended in the Civil War. In 1863, the need to finance the Civil War prompted Congress to pass the National Banking Act, offering federal charters to banks that invested 2/3 of their capital in the United States Treasury, U.S. New Bank. This lasted until the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. The rest is history. What can we take away from this brief history of the early American central banking? Both James Madison and Thomas Jefferson warned that the greatest threat to be feared was the public curse of public debt, and the banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. These founding fathers understood the dangers of centralized manipulation of the money supply, the hidden taxation of inflation, and the control of buying power. They understood that gold and silver are real money. Americans should heed their warnings by allowing gold and silver to be used once again as legal tender, at least something that's not sheer fiat currency. All right, well, this is not going to stop the Federal Reserve this June 2020. It's not going to stop them right now. It's not going to stop any of the Hamiltonians, the neo-Hamiltonians existing today. The logical consequences of what the founders could only come up with. A central banking model. And without it, all private banks just failing to function in any sound way. So think on that for a while. Think on what sound money like gold and silver, how it acts as a check and balance on big government, hedge against inflation, and a way to combat the manipulation of the Federal Reserve, aka the first bank in North America, aka the Bank of the United States, aka the second bank in the United States. It's the same thing. Question for Ben the Breaker of Banksters Cocker, and his answer will complete the third part of this Patriot Correspondence three-part series number 7. In 1994, Mr. Cochran, the Raghul Neal Interstate Banking and Branching Efficiencies Act amended the Federal Deposit Insurance Act of 1950 and the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956. The law allows interstate banking for the first time in the United States, signed by President Clinton, September 1994. For the past three decades, what has the Raghul Neal Act wrought?
Hold on. Stop the music. Are you supporting us on Patreon? Do you know that we are doing patron-only podcasts, videos, preparedness plans, incredible tools like our master preparedness schedule, all available at Patreon for $2 a month? $2. You've got that in your couch cushions. Not only that, that money goes to pay the bills for the network. We release ebooks from the hosts for free to our patrons. It's a tremendous opportunity. Not only is it a great value for $2 a month, but it makes a world of a difference for us. It pays the bills, to be frank. So support the network. Check us out at patreon.com/PBN. That's patreon.com/PBN. $2 a month. patreon.com/PBN.